Why is it, do you think, children are always too young to hear the truth, but never too young to be lied to systematically, conscientiously, in the name of education?
This is Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org.
Good evening. You are listening to Teachers for Class War here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, Freak Radio 101.1 FM. Tonight, our guest is Rogelio Martinez Saldana, who is a migrant education teacher with the Pajaro Valley Unified School District and a member of the Pajaro Valley Federation of Teachers since 19. I'm imagining that's 86, not 36. Because on the screen it looks a whole lot like it says you've been a member since 1936.
Exactly, 2004 or 5.
Yeah, that sounds a little more reasonable. You don't look like you've been a member of the union since 1936. Old time lefty. I'll read the rest of the bio just so we can give some context to the listeners here. Rogelio has closely followed politics in Mexico and the rest of Latin America. He recently returned from Mexico City, where he witnessed and participated in some of the actions of resistance carried out by members of the Mexican Electrical Workers Union, SME, after their union was eliminated by the Mexican government. Which brings us to the Real Work Mayday Labor Film Festival, which we'll probably announce several times during the show. But Rogelio will be speaking and we can talk a bit more about what that entails at the event, which is going to be Saturday, May 1st. No, this Sunday, is something Sunday. Different. It's, can you announce the date?
Yeah, it's Sunday, May 2nd. There will be the event at Watsonville's Cabrillo campus, including Watsonville on Strike and Y Se Hizo La Luz, a film about recent activity with the ESME, the Electrical Workers Union, recent organizing and action in fighting privatization efforts as you said in the bio, the decertification of their union, the fact that the Mexican government said, oh yeah, your union is no longer a legit representation. So Rogelio, welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the one of the largest and oldest and, as you said, best organized unions, labor movements in the hemisphere, in Latin America and the Americas. Talk about a little bit about the history of the ESME and your involvement with the organization or what you've seen in its role in Mexican politics.
Well, you know, as I grew up in Mexico, I knew not that much before I came to the U.S. about the ESME, the Sindicato Mexicano, the electricistas. But we knew, you know, since the early 1980s, you know, there have been great efforts by the Mexican governments to privatize almost everything that goes from the electrical companies, the oil industry, almost, you know, all the major companies that used to be run by the Mexican government. And since last year, you know, when I was here, I began to listen and read information about the attacks on the Electrical Workers Union. I was in Mexico City in December and January, and then I got to go to some demonstrations, you know, some events in support of the ESME, the SME, and obviously, you know, most of us could see very clearly, you know, that the government wanted to get rid of the union because it is an obstacle to privatize the electrical company, which is state-run in Mexico. And this is the second year I work with the people from the Labor Film Festival here in Santa Cruz. I presented a video 2 years ago about the teacher struggle in Oaxaca. And I really thought, you know, I talked to a co-worker who works with me in Watsonville. You know, we know about this video about the Electrical Workers Union. Probably we should show it. And she said, yeah, we definitely should show that. So that's how we get to really work on the event on Sunday. Mm-hmm.
And so electrical work is a fairly broad spectrum. What kind of workers are we talking about? What kind of industry? I mean, besides, is this power in general in terms of electrical power delivery, like PG&E is here?
More or less, yes. You know, in Mexico, there was the two companies, state-run companies, the federal company and the Lucifer's El Centro, the company that provides electricity to central Mexico, including Mexico City and the states around Mexico City. And these, they have probably, you know, the biggest market, you know, because they have the most populated states along Mexico City, which mm-hmm. by itself has, you know, with the surrounding areas, more than 20 million people. Mm-hmm. And the company is Lucifer's El Centro, and the union was the Sindicato Mexicano de Electricistas, you know, the Union of Mexican Electrical Workers. And the government decided, you know, suddenly that the company was going into bankruptcy, and they decided to blame the union. But, you know, it's really interesting how this came to happen, because on October 10th last year, you know, in Mexico, we all are soccer fans, you know, including myself. And on that day, the national team was playing El Salvador, and this was going to be a qualifying game for the World Cup in South Africa. And Mexico won, and Mexico made it to the World Cup. And I think that the government was thinking, you know, the people are going to be celebrating on the streets, in their houses, they're going to be drinking probably. So they decided to do, to seize the facilities of the company right after the game. And, you know, this made me think about, you know, this book written by Naomi Klein, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And the book is called The Shock Doctrine, you know, mm-hmm. where she talks about the rise of disaster capitalism mm-hmm. and how governments sometimes take advantage of a natural disaster to enact and implement laws when there is confusion, when there is fear. And that day on October the 10th, it wasn't a disaster, because it was supposed to be a party for the Mexican people, because the national team made it to the World Cup. Mm-hmm. But it ended up being a disaster for 45,000 families in Mexico, because that's when they took advantage of that to go to the facilities, seize the facilities, and declare the union eliminated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really a shame, really, on the part of the Mexican government, you know, because they did this, and the day after they said, okay, this is a legal document that declares the union unofficial, eliminated, it's gone. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, it's when you can see, you know, 45,000 families out there on the street suddenly, you know, and right away you can conclude, you know, okay, this is an effort to privatize the company.
Yeah. So I would like to rewind a little bit, because we're talking about there's this sort of declaration from above, mm-hmm. which to me sounds like paperwork and bureaucracy. It's sort of, you know, just we decided this. But clearly the people who made the decision are not the people on the ground doing the work. So what's the bridge, or what's the path from that declaration to the people who are out on the street suddenly? What does that transition look like?
You know, it's really hard that there was a transition, because mm-hmm. they said, okay, this is going to be gone tonight and that's it.
And so that meant that the workers suddenly had no job, or, I mean, what is that?
Yeah, suddenly they had no jobs. And they were offered something that we call in Mexico liquidation, mm-hmm. because they worked for several years or many years, mm-hmm. so they were offered money. Mm-hmm. And supposedly the opportunity to be rehired by the biggest company, the federal company. Mm-hmm. But the workers knew that that wasn't going to be really taking place, you know. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, they knew that they didn't know if actually that was going to happen. And at the same time, they knew that was illegal, you know, the way they did it, you know, and especially to this union, which is one of the oldest in Mexico, one of the strongest unions and one of the best organized. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when you think about it, you know, when you have a union that speaks up mm-hmm. for its members, mm-hmm. really well organized, the government doesn't like that.
Right. I mean, as soon as you're a threat to power.
Exactly.
They're going to try to eliminate the threat as much as they can, right?
Definitely.
So folks lost their jobs. How did it affect the folks receiving power? Was that also a disaster? Or, I mean, how did that go?
During the first days, you know, there were major blackouts throughout the city, in other part, Mexico City and other parts of the country. And the government tried to say, you know, it is the union members who are trying to sabotage, mm-hmm. you know, the administration of electricity to the city and to the other states. But the problem was that at some point the government didn't have enough workers mm-hmm. to do all the work to provide the electricity. And sometimes the workers who they were trying to use, they didn't know how to do it exactly, you know, because they had they didn't have the experience that the other workers had.
Of course.
Yeah. So for many days, you know, there were blackouts. You know, people began to complain. Even big businesses began to complain because they had no electricity.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious if they. I mean, this is kind of a side note, not about the labor, but I'm curious if they prioritized things like hospitals, or how did they. How did they allocate their resources in terms of skilled workers?
You know, I'm not really sure about that, you know, but it looks like even hospitals at some point, you know, they had no electricity, wow. You know, which became a major problem, of course.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah. That's telling right there. Mm-hmm.
And how did, so, you know, the effects for the folks doing the work, the effects for the actual, you know, delivery of electricity, what effects were there, you know, in terms of a reaction from the public, what was the public response? I mean, the hospital loses power, and who, did it get blamed on the union? Was there anger directed toward the government? How did El Pueblo respond? How did the people respond to this?
I think, you know, that fortunately, you know, most of the people could see that it was a maneuver by the government to get rid of the union, you mm-hmm. know, so they didn't blame the SME. Mm-hmm. And they turned their anger towards the government. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, you know, the ESME has had great support in Mexico City and other places. And that's why, you know, they're still fighting.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, too, about the effect on other unions. Did other unions take note of this and alter their strategies? And if so, who and how?
Definitely. You know, a lot of people became really afraid, you know, because not only because there is still a major crisis, economic crisis happening in Mexico because of the global crisis that took place all over the world. But some other unions, big unions like the social security unions and the telephone union, the people who work for the telephone companies, suddenly they became afraid. You know, if they did this to this union that was so big and so strong, who's next?
And so central to everybody.
Yeah. So when the SME decided to go out there on the streets, they had major support, you know, from the people, mm-hmm. fortunately. Mm-hmm.
Well, and this has happened before in terms of decertified unions. You mentioned the teacher struggle in Oaxaca, mm-hmm. and the federal government did the same thing, decertifying mm-hmm. Sección 22, and was just like, we're creating a new teachers union. Your teachers union doesn't count anymore.
Exactly. Right, no longer means anything.
So the labor movement then also responded in terms of other union labor and other workers.
Exactly.
What was the result then? What kinds of manifestations or events? What's the union's response been to being decertified?
You know, it's the fight right now is on the streets, you know, and sending communiques to the newspapers and somehow to call in radio or news programs, not TV programs, not that much, because, you know, the TV networks in Mexico are really close, you know, to what the government says. So they're not going to get the opinion from anybody on the street. So, as I said, you know, the fight is on the streets, you know, and there's all those unions, you know, show the support, you know, when they have major demonstrations, when they have fundraising activities, and they're still organizing and resisting.
What does the resistance look like? I mean, rallies, marches, political organizing, media work, what kinds of things did you see and witness when you were in DF?
When I was there, you know, I saw probably the same things that are taking place right now, the demonstrations, you know, a lot of artists, journalists, singers, you know, showing their support, the students, you know, from the university, showing the support for the Union of Electrical Workers. That's still happening. But somehow, you know, the government obviously is thinking, okay, at some point they have to get tired of it.
Yeah.
And we can tell that at this point, you know, the movement is still strong, but when you think that there were about 45,000, between 44 and 45,000 members of the union, and only 18 having accepted the offer from the government, you might think that, you know, that is losing force, and somehow it's actually happening. However, the fact that they're still resisting, and there is like 18,000 workers who are still demonstrating and, you know, making flyers and going to radio interviews and all those things, tells you that the movement is still strong. And I think, you know, that from now on it might become a little stronger because they are attracting a lot of attention within Mexico, sometimes from outside Mexico. And yesterday, the ESME began a hunger strike. in the main plaza of Mexico City called El Zócalo or Plaza de la Constitución. And they're going to be doing something like urban camping. And they're going to be on a hunger strike. I think between 10 and 20 workers began to do it yesterday, and they were going to be joined today by probably the same number of workers, and tomorrow more will join. And they're trying to put pressure on the Mexican Supreme Court to declare this an illegal action from the part of the government.
Wow.
So looks like, you know, at some point it may look that it's losing force. I think still very strong, you know, and I really hope that a lot of the people keep supporting them, you know, because they have a great support in the city.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of the privatization of industries in Mexico, where the television or the phone company fell and from a nationalized company and was sold, and you mentioned that there's a history of this where other industries, you know, there's been a push to privatize and essentially sell off state or public, really public assets. And sell them off to private and corporate,
to private companies and private hands. Yeah, you know, as people say, you know, beginning in the 1980s, you know, there was this big followers of neoliberal economic policies, you know, which dictates, you know, that the government shouldn't really be running the economy, that the government should stay out of the regulation of the economy, that the government should supply only the, let's say, the police and the army to keep law and order. And the Mexican economy...
Funny coincidence there.
And, you know, the Mexican economy was basically a mixed economy at the time. You know, it had a lot of private companies, but it had a big number of government companies. But, you know, obviously they came, beginning with this president, whose name was José López Portillo, early 1980s, who, by the way, said that he was going to protect the peso like a dog. And, you know, pretty soon after that, the peso devaluated by so much, you know. But he began, you know, implementing these economic policies, you know. He began to sell almost everything. It continued throughout the 80s and the 1990s. And you know, like, the banks, early 80s, most of them belonged to the Mexican government. And little by little, I think there's only one bank that belongs to the government now. And the air companies used to be owned by the Mexican government, they're gone. A lot of industries, like the sugar industry, part of it has been privatized. And what they really want, and it's only, you know, like more than 500 companies have been privatized, and they used to belong to the Mexican government. But what they really want to privatize is the electricity and the oil companies, you know, and they have had, they have made major efforts to do that, you know. But fortunately, you know, there was been a strong public opposition to that, you know. And even though they said that the oil industry is going down because there is not that much oil in Mexico, there is still some oil in Mexico, and they're really looking forward to at some point, you know, just sell it to American companies or European companies or even Mexican companies.
Do you see a difference in the sort of the popular response to this in terms of the rhetoric we're using in the United States versus what's being used in Mexico? Do you see dialogue is carrying a different form somehow, or is it pretty similar to what we hear here in the States?
You know, I think it's definitely different societies, different countries, different... So many things are so different, you know. But I think it's, one of the differences, for example, that I think... that in Mexico, people feel free, somehow more free to protest. Why? Because, for example, you know, I live here in the U.S., that if you don't work for 2 weeks, that's major trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Economically, yeah.
And in Mexico, you know, like during, in 2006, you know, when people were protesting, because for half of the Mexican people who voted, and perhaps for more than half of the Mexican people who didn't vote, the person who is the president of Mexico right now didn't win the election. So they were protesting for more than, I think, 46 days. And these were people who came not only from the city in Mexico City where all these protests were happening. These were people who were from Tijuana, from Cancun, from all over the country. And at some point I talked about that with some friends, you know, we were talking about, you know, do you imagine being there for a month and a half, camping, and I don't think even if we wanted, we could do that here in the U.S.
Right. So can people afford to do it? Can people afford to travel to do it? And can people imagine taking that time to do it?
Mm-hmm. You know, these were people who were there with their kids.
Absolutely.
People who were like in their 70s and 60s. And it was raining. It was hot. It was everything, you know. People did stay for more than a half, one month and a half.
That's an interesting point that it was people in their 60s and 70s because, I mean, a lot of folks in the States could use those older years to do that, right? I mean, we have a lot of people who are retired or who have saved up enough money, or for whatever reason, we could make use of folks in our labor struggles, and yet we don't see that as often. Exactly. We usually see college students.
Exactly. Yeah, probably because, you know, once you start working, I think probably you should have more freedom to do things, but it doesn't work like that, you know.
Mm. Well, yeah, it depends on...
You start getting indebted, you know, and things like that.
That's what I was going to say. It depends how you allocate your money. I mean, if you aren't a rampant consumer, there's a lot of jobs out there that will pay a decent wage, you know, and also if you don't buy a house, right? I mean, if you buy a house, you're done.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
But at the same time, there's this question of what we're accustomed to. What's the response when something like this happens? What model have you seen, or what, you know, where one family might say, well, I'm going to write my congressman, and another family might say, well,
I'm going to take to the streets
for a
month
and
a half.
Let's go down to the local radio station. Yeah. You know,
also there's a major difference, you know, because here, you know, you hear a lot about, you know, writing to your congressman, sending an email to your congressman, and do something, you know, communicate
with
your congressman.
That's your way to act up.
But in Mexico, people don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is that we don't really trust the government.
Well, and that's funny, right? Because people here, I feel like, a lot of folks here are likely to say, oh, I don't waste my time protesting in the street. I had a union teacher in my own school very recently say, yeah, you know, my days in the 60s are over. I already did that. I've marched with signs. I'm done. But she'll be the first to say, make sure you write to Arnold Schwarzenegger about this very pressing issue and send an email circular. Yeah. And so there's this perception of what is futile and what is useful going in both directions, right? I mean, we're both kind of criticizing either action. And it's not that, of course, one strategy is on one side of the board and the other strategy is on the other side, but...
Or that either one is effective or ineffective, but...
Right.
But there's the sense of what people are prepared to do and feel like is a normal response to something that's that serious.
Right.
Which, you know, which I think it was something nice when, you know, when I first heard about that, you know, being able to write to your congressman and saying, you know what, I don't agree with this.
Uh-huh.
But to be honest with you, I don't know if it works.
Mm-hmm.
But in Mexico, we won't do that, you know, because we are thinking, you know what, we're not going to change anything by writing to this deputy or to this senator.
Mm-hmm.
We'd rather go out there on the street and do something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's, I think that's also a big difference, you know, between Mexico and the United States when it comes to protests.
Yeah.
About a social issue.
And also how much people are willing to risk and how public they're willing to be about dissent. I think there's something very private about writing a letter and assuaging your guilt. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the film. Y se hizo la luz. Means and they made the and the light
let there be light.
Let there be light, basically, and they made the light come.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Sunday, May 2nd, at Cabrillo, and we'll talk about some of the events throughout the weekend. But who made the film, for what audience, and what kinds of images or what kinds of a narrative do you see in the movie?
The film is made by this organization called Canal 6 de Julio, 6th of July organization, you know, and they've been around probably for more than 25 years, I think. And what they do, you know, is that there is a really strong ties between the mass media in Mexico and the government. And sometimes, you know, when things like this happen, we only basically get one version of what happened, you know. So they decided to create this organization, you know, and produce these films to let people know from a deeper perspective and more freely, we can say that, you know, because usually, you know, when you watch the news in Mexico, sometimes they all sound the same, you know. So you need to see different, you know, and that's why this organization has become important, you know, Canal 6 de Julio. And as for this video, I think they really touch on the major aspects of what happened, you know, when it came to the elimination of the union. And if you allow me, I will say a few points of what they talk about in the video. In the video, they show how this maneuver by the Mexican government is unconstitutional. It is illegal. And two very well-known law professors from the National University of Mexico are taking the case against the Mexican government. And also, the use of the mass media, mainly the major two TV networks called Televisa and TV Azteca, to justify the elimination of the union. And they show in the video, you know, how the TV announcers, they all say the same, and they belong to different companies, but they all say the same. And also how the government wants to blame the union for the bankruptcy of the company. And at the same time, they want to set an example of intimidation against other unions. And they also saw how powerful businessmen who had ties to the Mexican government in the past, and they're interested, you know, in the elimination of the company because they can see that they can make a big business out of it. And also how the government denies the privatization efforts, but it's already happening. And that is, you know, clearly shown in the video. And also how the Mexican government lies, you know, when they say that, when they talk about job creation, you know, how are you going to be talking about the creation of jobs when you put almost 45,000 people on the streets overnight? And by the way, you know, Felipe Calderón, when he was a candidate for us for president, he said, you know, he was called el presidente del empleo, the president of employment. And you can tell also, you know, how the really rich, powerful men in Mexico are the ones who really are behind Felipe Calderón.
Well, so the let's run through the weekend plan for the listeners then, because we've got plans for you.
Okay, so are we talking the May 1st? We just roll.
Real work is already underway. They're already showing films.
Which, you know, this evening sounds like a wonderful one, but there's so many. So please check realwork.org for the schedule, and that's spelled R-E-E-L-W-R-O-K. Excuse me, W-O-R-K. That's what happens when you've been teaching too much.
Exactly.
check realwork.
Start with Friday, just for the weekend, assuming that the folks listening are probably workers, you know, were there. There's actually all the events all week long are scheduled so that workers can make it, and they're free. I should mention that too. The film festival is not a fundraiser. The film festival is designed to turn workers out for consciousness raising events, you know, for solidarity, and just, you know, a celebration of the contribution of workers leading up to May Day here. So
starting with Friday evening, we're going to rewind a little bit. Friday, April 30th at 8 p.m. in the Santa Cruz Beach Flats Community Garden, there's going to be an outdoor guerrilla drive-in sponsored, Real Work sponsored showing of the movie The Garden. I highly encourage everybody to come out for that because there are some really interesting correlations between the activism that went on in the Los Angeles South Central Garden and the garden that is here locally in town. So that's the first one, Friday, April 30th at 8 p.m. in the Beach Flats Community Garden. The second event that we have lined up for your weekend is the, what am I looking at? The Saturday one?
Yeah, like May Day for Real.
The Real May Day. Oh my goodness, how convenient. May Day's on a Saturday. Nobody's going to walk out.
May Day.
Yeah, so that means we expect everybody to show up because you don't even have to like leave work to come to May Day this year. All right, so Saturday, May 1st. At 4 p.m., there will be activities in the Watsonville Plaza, and at 5 p.m., a march. It's seeming like that's going to be a pretty major event. I've gotten emails from a lot of different folks.
One thing, yeah, that, you know, listeners should be aware of in terms of national politics, with what's happening in Arizona, there's a lot of momentum towards another big May Day rally. It's you know, I don't know if... I hesitate to use the word good timing for piss poor legislation.
Right.
But if they keep proposing anti-immigrant measures in April, Mayday is going to be
begging for a huge response.
Mayday is going to be back on the map as an International Workers Day in this country. So hey, you know, turn out on Saturday here in Santa Cruz or down south in Watsonville for worker solidarity and to really be involved in a response to what's happening in Arizona.
Absolutely, it's very very critical. It sounds like.
So, 4 o'clock then in Watsonville.
So 4 o'clock in Watsonville. It looks like there's activities in a sort of gathering, and then 5 p.m. is the actual march in Watsonville.
Okay. In Santa Cruz at the clock tower, I'm not sure of the time, but it's one of those tabs.
No, it's not. So we'll look that up for you.
but there is a community street party and celebration that's a little bit less official-like at 7:30. So I know there will be some kind of a Real Work-affiliated May Day event at the clock tower. I think it's on the actual Real Work calendar. But later on in the evening, there will be a further event, continuing rally beyond that particular gathering. So that's starting at 7:30 at the clock tower, International Workers May Day in Santa Cruz on Saturday. And then Sunday, the event at Cabrillo, what's happening around that event? What are the like the speakers and the films that are presented alongside Y se hizo la luz?
Go ahead, please.
There's the other documentary called Watsonville on a Strike, about the women who participated in the strike a few years ago in Watsonville, and they were demanding, you know, better pay. But at some point, they thought that their own union was betraying them. So they organized this strike, you know, that lasted for, I don't remember how exactly how many days, but for many days. And the documentary was produced by John Silver. He will be one of the speakers in Watsonville at Cabrillo Forum this Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some local context then. Again, it's, you know, to the listener who doesn't know anything about Mexican labor politics, there's a local connection in terms of showing Watsonville on strike.
Oh, definitely, I think. And also, you know, to the Mexican people who live in Watsonville, you know, because we're trying to do this a bilingual event, you mm-hmm. know, and you know, because as I said, you know, the Mexican people need to know what's happening in Mexico, and they need to know what's happening in this country too.
Absolutely.
And you know, you mentioned Arizona, and also I wanted to talk a little bit about it, you know, because, you know, when we are talking about the elimination of the union of electrical workers in Mexico, and the goal of the Mexican government is to privatize the company, there are American companies willing and ready to take over the company.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have these companies, you know, at some point working in Mexico and also pushing people out of their jobs, people are going to go to the cities in Mexico, and if they don't find a job in the city or the wage is too low, where are they going to go? To the United States. And then people say, you know, or want to do things like what's happening in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see, you know, it's not only just a one-sided phenomenon. American companies are doing things in Mexico that push the workers north. And then obviously here a lot of people think that it's just a Mexican problem, but it is not, you know.
Right. It's not just a matter of Mexicans dealing with their own government. It's also a matter of Americans on this side of the border really, really stepping up to the corporations that are going down and creating the situation in the first place, or generally assisting
the same, in that. The same people are profiting on both sides of the border.
Exactly.
It's the same group of people.
Exactly.
Yeah. And as you remember, you know, when people talked about immigration, they say, you know, we have the push and the pull. Something happened out of the United States and they come over here. But then, you know, we have to understand that sometimes American government, American companies are both the push and the pull.
That's what I was just going to say, yeah.
As it happened in the 1980s in El Salvador, you mm-hmm. know, and it's happening now in Mexico, and it has happened, you know, for many years.
Right, and somehow that tension is fueling the expanse of their pocketbooks.
And as you can see, you know, the free movement of capital,
mm-hmm.
that's allowed, you know, all over the world, you know, but there's no free movement of people.
Right.
Pues hablando de eventos bilingües.
Oh, desde luego.
Entonces, creo que cambiamos al español para repetir unos puntos importantes para otras gentes que están escuchando o que están parte de la comunidad. Estamos hablando con Rogelio Martínez, un trabajador, un maestro en Pájaro, aquí en Watsonville, sobre un evento que viene por el fin de semana, que es un cine, un evento, es un festival de cine para el Día Internacional del Obrero. Entonces, ¿qué va a haber en el domingo?
Buenas noches, mi nombre es Rogelio Martínez y bueno, el domingo tenemos preparado un evento con un par de documentales, uno que se llama Watsonville en Huelga, presentado por John Silver, y uno que estaré presentando yo que se llama Y se hizo la luz. Este último es sobre la ilegal acción del gobierno mexicano contra uno de los contra el sindicato más antiguo de México y uno de los mejores organizados. Y el video muestra cómo el gobierno decidió de la noche a la mañana terminar el sindicato, y desde luego mucha gente no solo piensa, sino que de hecho fue una acción ilegal y un ataque, la verdad, contra el sindicalismo en México.
Y ¿cómo te encuentras involucrado con el sindicato ahí en México?
Bueno, yo
del ESME.
Desde luego no tengo una relación directa con el Sindicato Mexicano de Electricistas, que se conoce como el ESME, SME, pero yo como mexicano crecí en México y desde que estaba en mis tiempos de preparatoria, que se conoce aquí en los Estados Unidos como high school, me interesé mucho por este tipo de cuestiones, y el tiempo que he estado aquí en los Estados Unidos siempre he seguido este tipo de eventos ahí en México. Y el pasado diciembre y enero estuve en México, y fue cuando se recrudeció la lucha del ESME por sus derechos y por la ilegal desaparición del sindicato que orquestó el gobierno mexicano. Entonces asistí a algunas manifestaciones, algunos eventos en apoyo a los trabajadores del Sindicato Mexicano de Electricistas, y obviamente he seguido el movimiento. Y pues yo creo que tanto en México como los mexicanos que vivimos de este lado de la frontera debemos apoyarlos, porque en primer lugar fue una acción ilegal por parte del gobierno mexicano. Y como muchos otros sindicalistas lo pensaron, si este fue un ataque contra un sindicato que es tan fuerte, tan antiguo y tan bien organizado, seguramente habrá más ataques contra otros sindicatos. Y como les digo, yo creo que todos debemos de crearnos una poquita de conciencia social y defender a los derechos de los trabajadores, aquí o allá.
¿Y qué relación tiene la ESME con el gobierno? O sea, ¿quién hizo la decisión para desaparecer al
sindicato?
Sí. Pues
de hecho la decisión parece que fue tomada simplemente por el gobierno mexicano sin consultar a nadie más. Como les comentaba hace rato en un momento cuando estábamos hablando en inglés, Naomi Klein escribió un libro que se llama La Doctrina del Shock. En ese libro ella habla de cómo muchos gobiernos aprovechan un desastre natural como el huracán Katrina, como el tsunami que pasó en Asia, y cuando existe esta atmósfera de pánico, de miedo, de confusión, ellos aprovechan ese momento para crear leyes que van en contra de los intereses de la gente. Ese día, el 10 de octubre del año pasado, no fue exactamente un desastre, pero después, posteriormente, sí se convirtió en un desastre. Pero ese día, como les comentaba hace un momento, en México nosotros, la mayoría, tal vez, no sé, el 80%, 90%, somos seguidores del fútbol de una forma muy profunda. No quiero decir fanáticos, porque fanático es una palabra que, la verdad, a veces tratan de hacerla ver como un eufemismo, como algo que es bueno, pero la verdad, la palabra fanático es de la gente que no piensa mucho y hace las cosas como quiere. Entonces, les decía, en México tenemos una gran tradición futbolera, y yo también me incluyo en eso. Entonces, ese día, el 10 de octubre, México jugaba un partido muy importante contra El Salvador, y sí ganaba su boleto al Mundial de Fútbol de Sudáfrica. Así sucedió. Y después del partido, y esto lo debe haber pensado el gobierno mexicano, cuando la gente iba a estar eufórica, alegre, cantando y celebrando, después del partido las fuerzas federales fueron y tomaron las instalaciones de la compañía de luz y fuerza del centro, que es la compañía para la cual trabajan los miembros del Sindicato Mexicano de Electricistas. Entonces, como decía Naomi Klein, los gobiernos se aprovechan de este tipo de circunstancias. Aquí no fue un desastre, eventualmente se convirtió en un desastre, pero vemos toda la intención de golpear cuando más se puede, cuando la gente va a estar distraída. Y así fue como se declaró esa misma noche que el sindicato ya no existía. Y para corroborar que fue un acto ilegal, el documento legal donde decía que ya no existía el sindicato como tal se emitió hasta el día siguiente. Es decir, no fue antes, sino hasta después.
Y los efectos entonces, primero en la infraestructura, la luz. ¿Qué pasó en los días siguientes?
Desde luego hubo mucha confusión entre la gente, porque obviamente cuando dicen esta compañía ya no existe, el sindicato tampoco, obviamente la gente dice, bueno, ¿y ahora quién nos va a proveer la luz? ¿A quién llamo si se me corta el servicio? Cualquier cosa de este tipo. Entonces hubo muchos apagones, como les decimos allá, por toda la Ciudad de México, muchos apagones en los alrededores de la Ciudad de México, en los estados de México Central. Y eso generó mayor confusión, mucha gente se enojó porque hasta ese momento, aun cuando el gobierno trató de desprestigiar al sindicato y a la compañía lo más que pudo, pues la gente mal que bien tenía su servicio. Y después de esto hubo muchas fallas, hubo muchos apagones, como les decía, y la gente sí se empezó a enojar y la gente empezó a darse cuenta que tal vez la culpa no era del sindicato, ni de electricistas, ni de la compañía Luz y Fuerza, sino del gobierno mismo.
¿Y cómo respondió entonces?
Obviamente el sindicato, al ser uno de los más combativos, de los más representativos del sindicalismo en México, se organizó protestando con manifestaciones, con plantones, distribuyendo información en las universidades, a través de la radio, a través de la internet, y ellos estaban preparándose para dar la batalla. También generaron mucha simpatía entre el público, por decirlo de alguna forma, común del centro de México y no solamente del centro de México, y han tenido el hecho de que todavía estén peleando es porque han tenido ese apoyo, que aunque a veces ellos piensan que debería ser más, y creo que sí, pero han tenido ese apoyo de la gente, de otros sindicatos, afortunadamente de muchos estudiantes, de gente joven y también de gente pues también que ya no está tan joven.
¿Qué forma entonces tomó la resistencia y qué sigue ahorita, no?
Hasta ayer, lo último que se programó hacer es una huelga de hambre masiva que ayer se inició en el Zócalo de la Ciudad de México, también conocido como la Plaza de la Constitución, y me parece que entre 10 a 20 trabajadores iniciaron la huelga de hambre ayer y paulatinamente se les van a ir integrando más trabajadores o de los que eran trabajadores de la compañía de Luz y Fuerza, y ellos dicen esto va a ser un acto masivo, a medida que pasen los días vamos a ver más y más y más en esta huelga de hambre ahí en la Plaza del Zócalo de la Ciudad de México.
¿Y tiene apoyo y solidaridad de los otros sindicalistas? O
Hasta ahorita no he escuchado algún pronunciamiento de ningún otro sindicato, pero yo leyendo los periódicos sé que hay mucha gente que está recolectando comida, agua, leche para ofrecerles a los miembros del sindicato, y en las universidades yo creo que sí existe un gran apoyo, también hay una recaudación de alimentos, de todo tipo de víveres para apoyar al sindicato. Como les comentaba hace un momento, al principio eran entre 44,000 y 45,000 trabajadores los que fueron despedidos. Lamentablemente, por un lado, hasta ahorita ya solamente hay 18,000 que están resistiendo sin recibir la ayuda que les prometió el gobierno, entonces mucha gente piensa, okay, si solamente ya están 18,000, quiere decir que más de la mitad ya no está con ellos, pero debemos de tomar en cuenta que muchos de los trabajadores tenían miedo, tenían familias, y ellos pensaron, mejor que me den un poco de dinero a quedarme sin nada. Pienso que tal vez lo correcto habría sido aceptar el dinero y seguir peleando de todos modos.
Entonces, en México hay una historia, no es algo nuevo hacer esta desaparición de sindicatos ni del proceso de una compañía nacional. Había una campaña de privatización por unos años a este punto.
Así es.
Si puede pasar un poquito sobre la historia de otros ejemplos. O.
Desde luego, pues más que nada, como ustedes saben, hay un sistema económico o políticas económicas que se llaman neoliberales. Ahora, ¿qué es lo que dictan estas políticas neoliberales? Es sacar al gobierno por completo de la actividad económica, es decir, que el gobierno se limite a proveer la seguridad para que los hombres de negocios tengan todas las facilidades para conducir sus negocios. Entonces, desde principios, bueno, todavía a principios de los años 80, México era lo que se llamaba una economía mixta, es decir, había capital privado, compañías privadas y compañías que eran parte del gobierno, y que más o menos hasta esos años estaban funcionando bien en México. Pero a partir de la implantación del modelo neoliberal, el gobierno mexicano empezó a deshacerse de sus compañías, y lamentablemente a precios de, como dicen luego, de venta de garage, muy baratos, y algunas de estas compañías terminaron en manos de ex políticos, ex miembros de gobierno, gente que había trabajado para el gobierno mexicano, algunas en manos extranjeras, y desde esos años, en la década de los 80s, se ha venido haciendo esto poco a poco, y el gobierno mexicano ahorita cuenta solamente con unas cuantas empresas, pero lo que ellos ven como el premio mayor son las compañías de la industria petrolera y la industria eléctrica, y no ha sido una vez ni dos las que han tratado de privatizar estas industrias. Y como se recordará, el año pasado y el año antepasado hubo una gran lucha social en México porque se habían, ahora sí que, de alguna forma propuesto leyes que indicaban la privatización del petróleo mexicano.
Sí, se puede decir o hablar poquito sobre la película, entonces, que vea en el evento en domingo. ¿Y quién hizo la película?
Bueno, el video está hecho por, el documental más bien, está hecho por una organización que se llama el Canal 6 de Julio, que ha sido una gran alternativa para millones de mexicanos, porque lamentablemente en México el papel de la prensa, sobre todo la prensa electrónica, tiene grandes lazos con lo que es el poder, el gobierno. Entonces, es muy fácil para el gobierno cometer este tipo de atropellos y muchos otros atropellos, aparecer en televisión y decir, no, es que no pasó así o fue de esta otra manera. Entonces, esta organización Canal 6 de Julio ya tiene muchos años haciendo estos documentales que proporcionan al espectador con una visión a veces mucho más profunda y más realista de lo que sucede. En el video lo que uno puede observar es inmediatamente cómo esto es un... El decreto del gobierno para eliminar el sindicato de electricistas es un decreto ilegal. Muestra cómo el objetivo último de esto es privatizar la industria eléctrica, sobre todo porque la compañía Luz y Fuerza ya se contaba con una red de fibra óptica que tiene más de 1.100 kilómetros de larga. Y a través de esta red de fibra óptica se puede hacer lo que llaman en México el triple play, es decir, proporcionar el servicio de teléfono, internet y cable. Y el gobierno quiere hacer negocio con eso y obviamente vio al sindicato como un obstáculo para poder llegar a eso. Entonces fue que, y eso se muestra muy claramente ahí en el documental que se llama Y se hizo la luz, y también muestra cómo el gobierno de alguna forma trata de enviar un mensaje a los otros sindicatos de intimidación, es decir, de coopera con nosotros o mira lo que te puede suceder. También muestra cómo el gobierno, ahí aparece el señor Felipe Calderón diciendo que esto no se privatiza ni aquí ni allá ni se va a privatizar, pero cómo de hecho y la privatización ya ha empezado. Y entre otros puntos también nos hace ver cómo, como tantas veces ha ocurrido en México, los candidatos ofrecen la luna y las estrellas y el último, no, el pueblo no se queda con nada. Felipe Calderón, cuando era candidato a la presidencia, él mismo se autodenominó como el presidente del empleo. Y estamos viendo que en México está ocurriendo exactamente lo contrario. No solo de un plumazo quiso deshacerse de 44.000 a 45.000 personas, sino que poco a poco mucha gente está perdiendo sus trabajos. Y todos estos puntos los toca el documental y se hizo la luz.
Toca también quién tiene interés en este proceso, quién está ganando, quién tiene algo bueno, quién va a recibir los beneficios de algo así.
Desde luego es la... si la meta es privatizarlos, los que van a recibir los beneficios son compañías mexicanas o incluso se mencionan compañías norteamericanas. Y es posible que hasta compañías europeas, españolas principalmente. Y obviamente el gobierno está frotándose las manos porque eso sería un gran negocio para ellos.
Pero es un proceso, es una reconquista. Porque si es las mismas compañías, entonces, de España, de Estados uh-huh. Unidos, entonces, antes o ahorita tiene un recurso público. Uh-huh. Y la idea o lo que buscan es venderlo otra vez uh-huh. a las empresas multinacionales.
Así es. Bueno, sí, efectivamente mucha gente lo ha empezado a ver así porque, por ejemplo, desde luego nada contra España ni contra los españoles, solamente contra aquellos que son explotadores. Pero mucha gente está dando cuenta que España principalmente ya tiene, me parece que, una especie como de 1,000 compañías operando en México, uh-huh. Que es muchísimo. Y aparte, durante la carrera presidencial del 2006, el ex presidente español, Felipe Aznar, vino a México y hizo algo que le es prohibido a él como extranjero en México, hacer política, y estuvo diciendo que por el bien de España y por el bien de México, Felipe Calderón, el candidato del PAN, debería ser el ganador. Y entonces mucha gente ya cuando vio este tipo de intromisión de un expresidente español y el poder económico que está obteniendo España de los negocios que está haciendo en México, mucha gente dice esto huele a reconquista. Y desde luego podría verse así, pero no solo son compañías españolas, sí hay muchísimas y desde luego de alguna forma ellos han sabido penetrar más que incluso compañías norteamericanas, pero como sabemos en México desde hace 100 años las compañías inglesas y las compañías de los Estados Unidos han estado ahí.
Por las noticias ahorita en los Estados Unidos está enfocado en Arizona, en la ley nueva o la ley que están tratando de impulsar ahí en Arizona sobre inmigrantes. ¿Qué efectos o qué relación tiene este movimiento o problema en México por la clima de obreros con la clima en Arizona y en los estados todos?
Pues hay algo muy interesante porque si se llega a dar que se privatice no solo la compañía de Luz y Fuerza una vez que han desaparecido ilegalmente al sindicato, obviamente puede ser que compañías mexicanas o compañías de Estados Unidos o compañías españolas se lleguen a apoderar de la industria eléctrica. Si lo vemos desde el punto de vista de que sean compañías de los Estados Unidos, entonces vemos que estas compañías de los Estados Unidos de alguna forma están contribuyendo a que el trabajador mexicano se quede sin trabajo en México. Obviamente, el trabajador, como por ejemplo le pasó a los campesinos con el Tratado de Libre Comercio de Norteamérica, al no encontrar trabajo, se fueron a las ciudades. Una vez en las ciudades, tal vez tampoco encontraron o encontraron trabajo muy mal remunerado, muy mal pagado. ¿Cuál es la siguiente opción? Ir a los Estados Unidos. Entonces vemos cómo las propias compañías norteamericanas están generando este clima, o están contribuyendo a generar este clima de anti-inmigrante que estamos viviendo, por ejemplo, ahorita como se vive ahorita en Arizona. Y como ustedes saben, en el pasado, cuando se hablaba de inmigración, se hablaba de la teoría del push y el pull, o el empuja y el atrae, o el jalar. Entonces se decía que la gente venía de otros países porque hubo una guerra por allá, o hubo una hambruna, o algo pasó, y el atractivo de progresar en los Estados Unidos estaba aquí, y por eso la gente venía aquí. Entonces eran dos factores muy diferentes, uno que estaba fuera de los Estados Unidos y los Estados Unidos mismos. Pero nos estamos dando cuenta que ahora con este tipo de cosas, por ejemplo, las compañías norteamericanas están siendo los dos factores. El que empuja a la gente fuera de sus países y el que los atrae a este país también. Y entonces cuando vemos estos actos de gente que viene de forma masiva de México o de otros lugares del mundo, no es tanto que sus gobiernos, bueno, sí es como en el caso de México, que son gobiernos corruptos, la verdad, y que no generan trabajos, pero es también que las compañías norteamericanas tienen participación en eso.
Entonces, son las mismas. Como siempre.
Desde luego, el capital puede ir y venir a cualquier lado, la gente no.
Vaya, así es. Si se puede repetir otra vez entonces los detalles del evento que viene.
Sí, me gustaría invitar a toda la gente a que asista el evento. Desde luego, el Festival de Cine del Trabajo tiene presentaciones en Santa Cruz, en Watsonville y me parece que también en Monterrey. Entonces los invito a que también lo revisen en la internet o pueden comunicarse tal vez aquí a esta estación. Va a haber películas muy documentales, muy, muy buenos, muy interesantes. Pero el evento del domingo en el que vamos a presentar este video que se llama Y se hizo la luz, va a ser en el Colegio de Cabrillo, Cabrillo en el campus de Watsonville, ahí junto de la plaza. Y vamos a presentar dos documentales, uno que se llama Watsonville en huelga, de John Silver, y este que se hizo la luz, del canal 6 de julio.
¿Y usted va a estar para hacer una presentación o?
Sí, yo estoy invitado ahí como presentador del documental Y se hizo la luz.
Muy bien. Gracias por tu tiempo, gracias por venir para estar con nosotros y para su trabajo y con este festival, es muy importante. Y para todos los que nos escuchen, entonces ahí por todo el fin de semana hay eventos marcando el Día del Obrero, que es el Día Internacional, el 1 de mayo, este sábado.
Sí, muchas gracias por haberme invitado y quiero felicitar a la gente que organiza esto del Festival de Cine del Trabajo porque es un evento magnífico. Yo creo que viendo todas estas películas, todos estos documentales, todos los beneficiamos para saber y ganar una poca de conciencia social.
Muchas gracias. A usted. Radio Libre Santa Cruz.